Now we're going to start it will only be a short series because it's only a short book, looking at this letter that we have for us. I've given it a little bit of an introduction this morning. We'll just try and get to the basics of how the letter's going to work. You know, and just to some obvious things, who's it from and who's it to? What's the basics of what is in it, this letter that we have before us? I guess the first thing to sort of deal with is, why do we call it 1 John? If you read through the whole letter, it might be a good idea to do that, if you can, over the next week or so, and you know, it gets you a whole sort of flavour for the whole of this letter. John's name is never in it. So why do we call it the letter of 1 John? But actually, for that matter, we've also got the Gospel of John in our New Testaments, and that's not named as being by him either. Both the Gospel of John and this letter here, they don't have his name to it. He never wrote at the end, "Love from John." And yet we can sort of pick up quite easily that they must be the same person. That's going to be our starting point. Must be the same person who wrote the fourth gospel and wrote this letter that we just started reading. They have very similar language, very similar themes, just in the opening verses of 1 John, ring an awful lot of similarities to the opening of John's gospel. These words he talks about, the word of life, the light that's come, the life that's been manifested, they're all very similar to phrases at the beginning of the gospel of John. And through the book, you'll notice lots of times he has big contrasts. He'll talk about light and darkness, children of God and children of the devil, truth and lies, love and hate, love of the world or love of God. These big, bold ways that this writer writes for us. And so it doesn't take an awful lot of stretch to work out that it must be the same person who's written both of these books in our New Testament, with all their sort of links of themes and words. So if we go to John's Gospel for a moment and work from there, who wrote the fourth Gospel? Again, it's not named in it. It must be one of the 12. The writer keeps labouring the point that he is an eyewitness. And so it must be somebody who's a very close eyewitness of the Lord Jesus. Not quite like Luke in his gospel, who clearly says he's not an eyewitness, but has talked to those who are. This is somebody who's there right at the first, who's watched the whole thing from start to finish of Jesus' ministry. It must be one of the apostles. Because of all the places that this witness is there in this fourth gospel. It must be one of the closest ones, you'd think, as well. And if you look through this fourth gospel, he actually mentions quite a lot of the apostles. He mentions quite a lot of detail about people like Peter and Andrew, even how they first met Jesus. He develops lots of the characters who are only very briefly mentioned in the other gospels. Philip, and Nathaniel and Thomas actually have quite a bit of detail given about them and some incidents of what happened in their time as disciples. Judas as well, of course. The most glaring people who are absent by name are James and John. Only once are they collectively mentioned in chapter 21 of the fourth gospel. It mentions the sons of Zebedee are there in the boat. The time Jesus appears to them after his resurrection. And he just mentions the sons of Zebedee were there. So James and John are never mentioned in the fourth gospel. As this has led then to people thinking that of course it must be John. We can rule out James because James is put to death quite early in the book of Acts. He wouldn't have really been around long enough to write the gospel or this letter that we're linking to it. And so let's work with that for the minute, and we'll hopefully see how it kind of fits with the gospel and the letter that we're briefly looking at this morning. Often John is called, especially when you look at the letter of 1 John, he's called the Apostle of Love, because he mentions it so much in his book. And yet if we trace his story just very briefly through those books, we see what a remarkable change has happened to him. The first kind of mention we have is in places like Mark chapter 1, and we read of Jesus going by the Sea of Galilee and calling James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who were in the boat with their father, mending their nets. And so that's when they're first called to follow Jesus. James and John, they always go that way round, so that probably means James is the oldest one. John's the youngest one. Some people guess that he could well, therefore, be the youngest of all the disciples as well. And there he is, he's called by Jesus. Mark chapter 3 tells us some of the time they're following him. And Jesus calls together and chooses 12 in particular. And he chooses and he lists them: Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James the son of Zebedee, and John the brother of James, to whom he gave the name Boanerges, that is, the sons of thunder. So there's an interesting snippet. We're told right from the very beginning that these two, James and John, are called the sons of thunder. They're fishermen, and the two of them are given this title by Jesus. The first recorded words of John happen in Mark chapter 9. And in Mark chapter 9, we read of him. Now, John answered Jesus, saying, "Teacher, we saw someone who does not follow us casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him." First recorded words of this disciple, John. And they're words of thunder, aren't they? That's why Jesus gave him this name, the sons of thunder, because him and his brother often seem to have been very argumentative, very passionate, fiery people who are willing to come down pretty hard on people like a ton of bricks, we might say. There's somebody who doesn't follow us and we forbade him, says John. We put a stop to that. We weren't having any of that nonsense. In Luke chapter 9, we have another incident of these two sons of thunder. In Luke chapter 9, verse 53, we read that they went to a Samaritan village and the Samaritans did not welcome Jesus. And when James and John saw this, they said to Jesus, "Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them like Elijah did?" There's James and John, the sons of thunder. And they're so angry with the Samaritans' rejection of Jesus, they're ready to call down hellfire and brimstone upon them, a bit like the towns of Sodom and Gomorrah, or one of the things that happened in Elijah's life as well. That's them with their thundery attitude. Very quick to pass judgment. Later on, one of the last times, we read of them in the Gospels, Matthew chapter 20. They're on their way to Jerusalem. It's just before the triumphant entry. And we're told in Matthew 20, verse 20, that the mother of Zebedee's sons, so that John and James's mother, comes to Jesus, asking that Jesus may grant that her two sons, James and John, would sit on Jesus' right hand and left hand when he comes into your kingdom. And they are there with him. Because Jesus says, you don't know what you ask. Can you drink the cup I'm about to drink? And they reply, James and John reply, yes, we're able. And so there's another recorded incident, James and John and their mum. And their mum asks for these positions of honour in Jesus' kingdom. And of course, it then turns into a great big argument about who's the greatest, because they've been arguing about that, I remember, plenty of times before. That's these two character. It's interesting in Matthew 20, the next recorded incident is about two blind men who begin to see. Maybe there's a little bit of hint that maybe James and John are a bit like that as well. So there they are, these passionate, fiery, judgmental, proud, arrogant, who always think they're the greatest, who seem to think they know best, often even know better than Jesus. They tell Jesus what he should do and so on as well. Are blind to what Jesus is really doing. But, on the upside, he carries on following Jesus. Here he is. He's a right case, isn't he? John and his brother. But they love Jesus and they follow him. So they're in the right place, aren't they? Listening to him, watching him, listening to his ministry, hearing his words. They're in the right place. Jesus welcomed sinners to himself, didn't he? He didn't say, "No chance of my taking you, James and John, to be my disciples. You're far too feisty and argumentative. I can't do anything with you." Jesus called them, fallen as they were, arrogant as they were, proud and the rest of it. Jesus called two sinners, James and John, the sons of thunder. That in following him, in watching him, they would come to faith. In John's gospel, the fourth gospel, as we said, John is always nameless. And here he has this interesting thing. We have this disciple in the second half of John's gospel who's always referred to as the disciple that Jesus loved. And that, most people will assume, is John. It happens in the Last Supper. There's one of the disciples, John 13:23, who's there by Jesus. They're all reclining around the table. And this disciple is really close to him, so he can lean back on Jesus' chest. And he's referred to as this disciple whom Jesus loved. And he's there. He's there at the cross in John chapter 19. The other gospel writers suggest that everyone dispersed and all the disciples ran away. And probably he did too, but then he comes back. And there at the foot of Jesus' cross stood Mary, his mother, his mother's sister, and others. And Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing by. And he entrusted this disciple to look after his mum when he was going to die. There he is, back at the cross of Jesus. In John chapter 20, we read of Peter and another disciple running to the tomb, the disciple Jesus loved. And there we read of him that he believed when he saw that the tomb was empty. In John chapter 21, they're fishing by the Sea of Galilee, and they see a man on the shore who tells them to cast their nets on the other side. Remember the story? And they catch fish, so many at that moment. And the disciple Jesus loved says to Peter, "That is the Lord." And Peter jumps out of the boat. He's the first one to recognize who it is. And then at the end of John chapter 21, Jesus is talking to Peter and he restores Peter back as one of his disciples. And we're told that there listening was the disciple whom Jesus loved. And then he finishes this book saying, "This is the disciple who testifies of these things, and he writes these things, and we know his testimony is true." So you have this disciple who Jesus loves, who then writes this gospel. And reading between the lines, it can only be John. He's the only one who fits all of these different situations to be there and to always have this feature that he doesn't want to draw attention to himself, but sort of cryptically refers to himself and puts himself perhaps in the background a little bit in this way. So, sorry that I had to do a little bit of legwork in that, but I hope it's something good in a sense to realise how we can work out that John's the author of the fourth gospel and therefore is the author of this letter we have here. And I hope that wasn't just a little bit of boring church sort of history behind it, but also just drawing our attention to the fact of this wonderful change to this man. He's this fiery, proud, arrogant sinner who follows Jesus for 3 years. And he makes so many mistakes. And he goes off the deep end. And he gets so angry about this, that and the other. And yet he follows Jesus. And he watches and he listens and he learns. And what is it that transforms him? Well, he knows that he's loved by Jesus. Isn't it? That's why he refers to himself in that way. Because you can get some of his amazement as he writes it down in his gospel, as he writes down the disciple that Jesus loved was there at the Last Supper, was there at the cross, was there at the tomb. And every time he writes it down, you can almost see John taking his pen off the paper and breathing a sigh, thinking, "Boy, how astonishing is that? I'm the disciple that Jesus loved." And that, of course, comes across in his letter. He says, "This is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us." And that's how John writes his gospel. He's not the disciple who loves Jesus, although I'm sure he does. But it doesn't start with that. It starts because he's been loved by him. He stood there at the cross, and perhaps, maybe with looking back at it, he realised what it was that Jesus did. but the one who loved him and died for him. He ran to the tomb, and there he believed. It began to dawn on him what Jesus had done. And so it's amazing, isn't it, that he goes from being the son of thunder at the beginning of the Gospels to the end of the Bible, he's the apostle of love. Only Jesus changes people like that, isn't it? Only Jesus can take us, sinful disciples who are making a right hash of things. Maybe we're a son of thunder too. Maybe that's our besetting sin of pride and anger and the like. Maybe it's something else. Maybe it's greed. Maybe it's lust. Maybe it's lying. Maybe it's selfish. Whatever it is that we're a son of by the human nature, he's transforming us. And as we come to know that we are loved by Jesus who gave himself for us, as we come to have that faith in him, he changes us too. And he stands there at the cross watching Jesus die. He believes there at the tomb. He's there in the boat and he recognizes before anyone else does that that is Jesus. And he's the eyewitness who writes it all down. That's John's big point in his gospel. This is not some cleverly made up story. This is what we're writing down, what we're eyewitnesses of. And that really helps us then. Our letter of 1 John. So, that's who it's from. The apostle of love. And what a striking change has happened to him. Who's it to? Well, the assumption is this is written to a church, the churches in Ephesus. Just to give very, very briefly a little bit of the dates which I think work well with this. Jesus died roughly the year AD 30. In about the year 53, Paul goes to Ephesus on one of his missionary journeys. He stays there for 2 years. There's more details of that in Acts chapter 19. In about the year 55, Paul moves on and he writes the letter of 1 Timothy, sending Timothy to Ephesus. So Timothy stays there for a while. In Acts chapter 20, we read of Paul journeying back to Jerusalem, going via Ephesus. And he says farewell to the elders who are there. And then in the end, Paul is arrested when he gets to Jerusalem and goes to Rome about the year 60. He's imprisoned and he's in prison for a little while. Then he's let out. Then he's rearrested and it's Emperor Nero. You might remember some of your history at that time. He writes the letter of 2 Timothy, asking Timothy to leave Ephesus and come and join him in Rome. And that seems is right near the very end of his life. And Paul is probably martyred in about that time, the year 62. So a guess would be that John then, after Timothy leaves Ephesus, Ephesus is kind of on its own, and Ephesus is a key place. And so the guess is that John then goes to Ephesus about that kind of time, while they're sort of left a little bit in the lurch. Working backwards, if the year 70 is when the fall of Jerusalem is, my hunch is that John wrote the letter of Revelation in AD 69. That's during the reign of Emperor Vespasian, who's the one who exiles John to the island of Patmos. And if you want to work back one more year, then at a guess, maybe the letter of 1 John is written about the year 68. And that would be my sort of hunch of how those things sort of come together and all get done by the time you get to Revelation. It may also have another link to Revelation. In Revelation, you get the letters to the 7 churches, which start at Ephesus. And there seems to have been this little circle of churches that sprang out of the work in Ephesus into the area around. And John sort of writes in Revelation to those same churches, and it seems quite likely that it's the same sort of circle of churches that are in mind in here in this letter of 1 John. But they are a church in danger. And that sort of comes across quite a little bit in that little snippet of history. Paul stays there for 2 years. Teaching in that place, because that was a key place, longer than he spent almost anywhere else. And it seems that during that time of ministry, that churches were planted in all the area, maybe the sort of county, we might say, around it. But if you look in Acts chapter 19, Paul ends his ministry there with a riot that comes up. So he has to move on, but he asked Timothy to go and stay there. And in the letter of 1 Timothy, he keeps telling Timothy to keep teaching the truth about Jesus. Teach no other doctrine. He warns them about false teaching that will come their way. In Acts chapter 20, as we were suggesting just now, when Paul is on his journey to Jerusalem and calls in via Ephesus, he has some very poignant words he gives them in Acts chapter 20, verse 29, when he says, "After we've gone, savage wolves will come in and will not spare the flock." He warns them about false teaching. That seems a big thing that Paul stresses for the church in Ephesus. And maybe that's why John goes there, because it's such a key place and it's going to come under attack. And John goes to Ephesus. He seems in church history that he had quite a long time of ministering there. He writes this letter to them there as well. And this letter is written because they're in danger. There's this false teaching creeping in. Principally, the letter's written to Christians. It's interesting. At the end of John's gospel, he says, "These things I've written so that you may believe, and that by believing you may have life in his name." John wrote his gospel so that people would become Christians. In 1 John chapter 5 and verse 13, he says this, "These things I've written," same phrase, "to you who believe in the name of the Son of God, that you may know you have eternal life, and that you may continue to believe in the name of the Son of God." So in many ways, the letter of John follows on from the gospel. The gospel is there so that you may believe. And the letter he then writes so you may carry on believing, and so that you may know you have eternal life. So he writes to them, and it's a letter trying to assure them, trying to keep coming back to the truth, to help them continue to believe. And that's a helpful thing, isn't it, for us? Perhaps some of us have come to believe. But we still need that help, don't we, to continue to believe. Perhaps there are some who have they might think of it as a very fragile faith. They think, yes, I have put my trust in the Lord Jesus, but I've made such a hash of things, and I've made a mess, and I'm full of doubt, and I don't really understand. Well, a letter like this is for you. It's there to help us continue in the faith when we're under attack, when we're struggling, so that we may know we have life. We read the first few verses from 1 John chapter 1, and he said in verse 4, "These things we write so that your joy may be full." He wanted those Christians who were under a threat, who were struggling, and maybe filled with doubts and fears. He wanted them to know they had life, and he wanted them to have joy. And isn't that what we need? John wrote this letter to churches that were going to come under intense persecution. He was going to be exiled to the island of Patmos, probably only a little bit after this letter's written. Persecution was going to come on the church. There were false teachers already at work. He wanted to encourage them to keep going and to have joy as they continue to believe in Jesus. And so he writes to them. It seems perhaps they're quite young in the faith. Often he has that little phrase, chapter 2, verse 1, "My little children, I write to you." That might be because they're very young in the faith. It might be also because John's very old. At a guess, he could easily be in his 70s, some people think in his 80s. He's been following Jesus for 40, maybe 50 years at this point. So it's a long time has happened. And John can write to them, this dear old apostle who's followed Jesus for so long, he can write to these young children, tell them to keep going, to have joy as they follow Jesus. He's the loved apostle who cares for them. You get that in so many of his phrases. At chapter 3, verse 1, "Behold, what manner of love the Father has given to us, that we should be the children of God. The world does not know us because it did not know him. Beloved, we are the children of God." Get some of the loving language with which he talks to this church. And the last little thing, as we said already, is because they're under attack. He says to them in 1 John chapter 2, verse 18, "Little children, it's the last hour, and you've heard that the Antichrist is coming, and many Antichrists have come," which we know this is the last hour. "They went out from us, but they were not of us. For as they'd been of us, they would have continued with us. But they went out that they might be made manifest that none of them were of us." It actually is a little bit similar to the little phrase that Paul uses when he says, "Savage wolves were arise within you, seeking to devour the flock." And here John says there were people who came up within us, and then they've gone out, and now we realize that they weren't really Christians at all. and they're the ones who are peddling this false teaching and the like. So John writes them because they're in danger. Last little bit, we've just to give a little bit of the flavour of the letter. We've got this apostle of love. He loves his Christian brothers and sisters. He writes to his little children. But he's also an apostle who's standing for the truth. There's still something in him that's a son of thunder, but now for good. And some of his words in this letter are going to be really strong and really fiery, but for a good cause now. He's passionate about protecting God's people, about combating false teaching. So just to give you a tiny flavour of how the book roughly works, in this time it seems that the churches in Ephesus were infected with a false teaching that later on became known as Gnosticism. Don't need to worry too much about that. That really only happened at least 100, 200 years later. But there was the seeds of it that came from a kind of Greek way of thinking. And this is just that there are two big things going on in the world. There are spiritual things and material things or physical things. And there's a big divide between that. And the spiritual stuff is good. And physical stuff is bad. It's rubbish. And that's the way they saw the world. And they kind of read that in then to sort of Christian stuff. And then twisted it to kind of fit how they liked. And so this was the big sort of way of thinking that people had around this sort of time. But it had some big problems that came with it. One big problem was that if spiritual is good and material is bad, how can the Son of God become material? How can he become physical? And so one big strand of their false teaching was that Jesus wasn't really human. Maybe he borrowed a human body. Maybe it was somebody else, and Jesus just temporarily dropped in on him and lived with him for a while, and then, of course, went. He couldn't take part in death, because that's even worse, isn't it? Jesus becomes a man and dies. They couldn't handle that. So they had this idea, Jesus isn't really human. So that was one of their ways of teaching in that. That's one of the ways they sort of had a big sort of hang-up with it. So everything just became a sort of fudge of different ideas that they had. You couldn't be sure Jesus did that or said that. We'll just sort of make it up as we go along. Second big problem was that if only the spiritual mattered and the physical didn't, well then who cares less if you sin? If you do something with your body and sin, it doesn't matter at all. So you can do what you like. And that was the next little bit of their false teaching. You can sin however you like. You can be completely immoral, completely unholy, because it doesn't matter. And the third thing this led to was that if you've got spiritual people and physical people, well, the more spiritually enlightened you are, then you're better. And so this led to a pecking order, that you had these elite Christians, in inverted commas, who were super spiritual and just sort of drifted along on a cloud. And they're the good ones. And everyone else is rubbish. Those were some of the big false teachings that were going on. And so John, in his letter, keeps cycling around, and it's a little bit strange because we tend to go in their way of, they often would spiral in as they sort of think through an argument. And so John keeps coming back round to the same things. And he's got three things that are going to keep coming through the letter. Truth matters. There's all this fudge about, we can't really be sure about Jesus at all. Yeah. Here John begins his letter. This is what we've heard and seen and looked on and touched with our hands. We saw it. We are witnesses. We declare it to you. We've seen, we've heard, we declare all of these things to you. He keeps labouring the point. This is not some made-up story. What you need to hear is the truth about the real historical Jesus that we were eyewitnesses of. He says, this is it. We need to know this truth about Jesus, about his incarnation, about his life, about his death on the cross, about him rising again. These facts of the faith. And that's one of John's big points in his letter. And that's really relevant. Gnosticism may sound like 1,000 years ago, it is, but kind of some of the stuff is still around. And we kind of hear all kinds of people who like to fuzzily reimagine Jesus and make up all kinds of stuff and cross out the bits they don't like and reinvent a Jesus that they want. And often it is some sort of mystical, spiritual feeling and stuff like that. Well, John keeps coming back. No, this is the truth, what we saw and heard of Jesus, the facts of the historical Jesus. This other point, that sin, you know, you can do whatever you like, who cares? Well, John keeps labouring the point through his letter that what matters is obedience. If we say, verse 10, we have not sinned, we make him a liar. And this is what we should do. We should practice the truth, we should walk in the light, we should obey. And that's really relevant too, isn't it? Say, Gnosticism is old stuff. But the same sort of teaching is there in all the sects and all the sort of modern heresies around. All have the same endpoint, that you can do whatever you like. But John keeps coming back and saying, no, obedience matters. Walking with Jesus is what matters. And the last thing, in this sort of elitist, competitive atmosphere that this false teaching bred, that led to people being so arrogant and unloving, John labours the point through the letter of love. That we need to love one another. And we can't say we love God if we don't love other Christians who are around us. And again, that's a massively relevant thing, isn't it? Although Gnosticism's long gone, the kind of the false teachings are the kind of same old false teachings that are around all the time. And again, all the heresies and offshoots of Christianity going off in funny directions all breed a sort of elitism and superiority. And so, John keeps coming back to this core of truth and obedience and love. And John's kind of repetitive because he'll almost go through the same 3 points in every one of his 5 chapters. And it'll be the same thing. Truth matters, obedience matters, and love matters. And so hopefully that's just a little overview to help you get the idea of how the book works, and hopefully it'll help us to get our teeth into it as we start that in the weeks ahead. But hopefully just in a little flavour of it gives us something to think about as we think about that transforming work of God's grace in John, as we think about his passion and concern for those Christians who are in danger, as we see those dangers of false teaching and the same dangers which are there in our hearts through temptation. And John keeps coming back to the truth of Jesus, obeying him, walking with him, and seeking to love others, we who are the disciples that Jesus loved.